The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, What Should Black America Do If Trump Wins a Second Term? As the 2020 election approaches, the idea of another 4 years with the current occupant of the White House is a scary prospect, but we aren't giving up the fight. Election night in 2020 of November looms large in our minds. So does the unsettling possibility that President Donald Trump might be successful in his bid for re-election, subjecting the country to 4 more years of his administration. Although former Vice President Joe Biden is currently leading in the polls, Trump's win against Hillary Clinton in 2016 has taught us that nothing is ever certain. If Trump secures another term, many Black people feel as though our communities will face a severe existential threat. Many of the consequences of the past 4 years have already been catastrophic for us. The rollback of almost 100 environmental protections, the historic rise, a 16-year high in 2018, according to the FBI, in racist and xenophobic hate crimes, the devastating and disproportionate deaths of people of color from the new coronavirus. The livelihoods of millions of Black and brown people are quite literally at stake in this election, states Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. We have already seen exactly what happens when Donald Trump is at the wheel. 130,000 dead and counting from a disease that the White House ignored. And in every age group, most of the dead are Black. In my home state of Minnesota, the coronavirus has taken the lives of Black people at twice the rate of their white counterparts, including my own father. In June, Omar's father, Nur Omar Muhammad, passed away at 67 years old due to complications from COVID-19. None of us want to see any more of our loved ones die. Nor do we want to live in a state of perpetual fear. So, while it may be painful for many to think about how should Black people confront the possibility and minimize the chances of another Trump win, across the political spectrum, the responses vary. For many, the answer is to fight to elect Joe Biden, who has struggled to connect with some young Black voters as president. Others recommend decentering electoral politics, focusing instead on sustained efforts to defund the police and build intergroup alliances, while still others suggest leaving the United States altogether as the course to try. Focusing on state and local elections is a good way to mitigate the harm of 4 more years of Trump. As Colorado State Representative Leslie Herrod asserts, we have to make sure that we vote the entire ballot because there is protection at the state level and at the local level. She points out that having Democrats in control of the state's Congress and the governor's office enabled Colorado to make progressive policy changes at the state level. One example is the recent Law Enforcement Integrity Act, which Herrod helped pass in the wake of widespread protests after Trump won in 2016. While it is not the federal change that I think a lot of us want to see, it does impact everyday lives, Herrod states. Although mutual aid within communities has gained popularity as a concept in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis, it had historically been how many groups survived in the face of oppression, especially Black people. Maurice Cook, a 50-year-old DC-based community organizer, says that his generation was the first to witness a transition from an autonomous Black community to one, he says, grew increasingly reliant on quote-unquote government subsistence. During legal segregation, Cook says, Black people didn't have a choice but to provide for ourselves in all areas of life. Somebody had the garden with the beets, potatoes, and the squash, he says. Somebody had the pigs, somebody had the steers, and somebody had the cows for milking. We did it ourselves because we had to. We had carpenters, we had plumbers, we had doctors, and we had teachers. We all took care of one another. Herod agrees that this kind of mutual aid has become more necessary than ever. We really have to make sure that we are supporting ourselves within our own communities so that we can weather the storm, she says. At the end of the day, Black folks can get through anything. We shouldn't have to, but we can. We are stronger when we do it together. For some who see leaving the country as the best option, the nation is past redemption, says Daniel Ash, who left the U.S. for Costa Rica in 2014. I did not want to live in a country that was built upon systems of power, privilege, and oppression that continue to this day. I no longer wanted to live in a country that brought my ancestors here through human trafficking. Ash believes that Black folks should consider leaving the country no matter who wins in November 2020. I don't think that this country is safe or healthy for anybody, she says. Though the proposed solutions differ radically, there is a common thread among all these responses to how we can prepare for the possibility of a Trump 2020 win. None of us believe in giving up the fight for justice. We have an opportunity to reject an ugly vision of America, says Omar. In order to defeat Donald Trump and elect Joe Biden, it is going to take all of us. It is going to take a multiracial, multigenerational grassroots movement demanding change. The next article is titled Lessons from the Pandemic. Amid heightened racial tensions and the outbreak of a deadly disease, good leadership is taking on a new meaning. On a Saturday afternoon in Newark, New Jersey, 5 days after George Floyd died while in custody of Minneapolis police, Newark Mayor Ross Baraka stood behind a podium in downtown Brick City. When you put a hand over mouths that continuously try to speak, they get louder and louder and louder, he declared to a crowd of peaceful demonstrators. People are going to express themselves, and we have to give people the room to be outraged. Baraka's presence at the protest, coordinated by the People's Organization for Progress, set an urgent tone in troubling times. Given the mayor's family history of activism and his denunciation of centuries of quote-unquote purposeful and deliberate systemic abuse in our country, it was only natural that he would raise his voice alongside the people of his city and be among those leading the chants. Protesting injustice, advocating for Black lives, and fighting the very system that thwarts African Americans in their efforts to achieve the American dream is nothing new for Newark residents. Some might argue that little has changed since the long, hot summer of 1967, when race riots rocked the city after a black cab driver was beaten by two white cops. But now, amid a life-threatening outbreak, the circumstances feel different. "I don't want to be down there because of COVID," Baraka confesses, after pleading with his constituents to shelter in place. But the pandemic of white supremacy and racism, coupled with the pandemic of COVID, is something that we have to deal with. For Baraka, who has been at the helm of Newark since 2014, leadership looks a bit different in the age of COVID-19. In addition to addressing quality of life issues that have plagued a large portion of the municipality's majority African American population for decades, he must now help the people of New Jersey's most populous city grapple with a pandemic that disproportionately affected black people. In his responsibility to constituents, the former Newark Public Schools principal is not alone. When San Francisco Mayor London Breed was first briefed on the possible implications of the coronavirus on her city, she immediately launched an equity team to make certain no one falls through the cracks and incorporated it into her emergency operation system. "I knew, as someone who grew up in public housing, that if you lose your job or if you don't have any money coming in, you are done," Bread says when speaking about the reasoning behind that decision. She admits that the lack of resources for some of her constituents, many of whom are African American, was an immediate concern, with a segment of households lacking broadband internet connection. Disseminating important information meant coming up with a catchy campaign, not only to inform communities about the virus, but also to alert them to ways the city could help alleviate some of the financial challenges they might face. Bread proudly shares that her efforts have been impactful. "For the most part, people are being well taken care of because we have been able to leverage private and public support and outreach to those communities that typically would probably get left out," says Bread. In March, as legislatures in Congress scurried to find solutions to the country's rising unemployment number and high rates of financial instability, right-wing pundits accused House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, another San Francisco resident, of hijacking the current moment to push a liberal agenda. But spurred on by her concern for those who would most likely suffer the most, Pelosi made it known that as far as she was concerned, no expense should be spared to provide relief to the millions of Americans out of work and those fighting the disease. Since the start of the pandemic, the highest-ranking female elected official in the nation's history has worked closely with the Congressional Black Caucus to craft legislation that addresses the disparate toll the virus has taken. The COVID-19 pandemic has opened the eyes of so many to the crisis of injustice that for too long have torn apart the soul of our nation, Pelosi explains. "We are at a turning point, and we must rededicate ourselves to the work of our founders to form a more perfect union with liberty, equality, and justice for all." As the leader of the Congressional Black Caucus, Karen Bass has played a key role in protecting the interests of Black Americans in a turbulent and taxing time. When it comes to racism and state-sanctioned violence, both of which have been exacerbated by the pandemic, Bass says she will work tirelessly to pass bipartisan legislation to help our communities. But it is important to note that we all share in the responsibility to move the needle toward justice. The Congresswoman from California sincerely believes that voting for Joe Biden in the November election is a matter of life and death. If the former vice president does in fact become the next president, he will inherit a country stricken with serious health concerns, widespread fears of a financial meltdown, and a deeply divided society. On November 3rd, voters will decide if Biden is up for the challenge of healing our country on all these fronts, including heading the Black community's calls for equal opportunity and justice. As Baraka put it on that May afternoon when he addressed Newark's protesters from the steps of the historic county courthouse, the anger rising up from the streets is not just about George Floyd. We are talking about hundreds of years of lynching, of abuse, of segregation, of purposeful denying of housing, of poverty, of unemployment, Baraka stated. Amid dueling pandemics, it is increasingly clear that bold leadership will be the only way to calm the swells. The next article is called Thrive, Living in Black. Meet three interior design enthusiasts who decorate with the diaspora in mind. Black interior design stars are raising the game in a nation roiled by the criminal deaths of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd, and amid the COVID-19 pandemic and the global hashtag Black Lives Matter movement, these creatives are continuing to center Black culture and inspiration. Ariane C. Bathia at Dress My Room, owner and creator Dressing Rooms Interiors. Ariane C. Bathia is a self-proclaimed maximalist. She prefers her rooms full so that wherever your eye lands, on a gallery wall with framed prints by South African visual artist and social activist Zanele Muhle, or on a set of leopard print dining chairs from the 1980s, they are constantly discovering something new. "I buy what I love," says Bethea, owner of Dressing Rooms Interiors, a vintage home furnishing boutique and digital bazaar. The business offers novel pieces to select clientele and reinforces her eccentric aesthetic. "If you love it, you will find a place for it," she says. "I let things tell me where they want to live." And she listens. Heirlooms, statues, sculptures, and other artworks occupy the many nooks in her Charlotte, North Carolina home. Bethea encourages those interested in injecting Black culture into commercial and residential design to identify what aspect of the Black experience they connect with most. "Do the homework to figure out what is important to you," she says. For her, it's photography and artifacts from the civil rights and Harlem Renaissance eras. She also cherishes her collection of elaborate African masks and a velvet Bernhardt sectional, all inherited from her mother, whom Bethea credits for her gift of curating spaces. "My home is a refuge," she says. "I am really passionate about people creating homes that are authentic to them and not copying and pasting someone else's style." Cameron Hamilton, founder, creator, Newbie Interiors. "There's always an opportunity to live well," says Cameron Hamilton, a Memphis-based interior designer and content creator who documents thoughtful transformations on her lifestyle blog, Newbie Interiors. "I don't care what your income is or what your circumstances are. There's something that can be done with what you have to make you feel proud of where you are." For Hamilton, that pride translates to weaving ancestral antidotes and natural elements throughout the 2,000 square foot Tennessee residence that she shares with her husband and 11-year-old son. In the hallway, Serengeti wallpaper mixes with gold and brown accents to transport you to Tanzania. Natural and custom lights overflow in the home office, Hamilton's favorite room, illuminating the textures, patterns, books, and artwork, and setting off the open space. The living and dining areas feature melange of cultural elements, plants that decorate surfaces or hang in planters, textured pillows, a tassel chandelier, embroidered leather floor cushions, and souvenirs of memorable moments, all in complementary hues. But although Hamilton's home is highly stylized, it's grounded in clean lines, she says. My approach is modern bohemian. I layer unconventional elements over quality pieces that will stand the test of time. Nori is her signature. She features the color on vases and fireplaces, and she is intentional about commissioning work from Black artists. Any space that I create, she says, especially for Black clients, I want people to walk in and know Black folk dwell and thrive here. The last interior designer is Talia Faulkner, owner, creator of Artisan Nail Studio. I am very Black, says Talia Faulkner. My husband, Carrick, and I live in a historically Black community. We ride for Black people, and we are proud of our culture. This fact is evident as you scroll through the couple's Instagram feed. Each box feels like home. Good luck leaving their virtual southern crib. Faulkner, a creative nail tech and the owner of Artisan Nail Studio, is known for integrating familiar patterns and textures into her workspace and living space. When my clients walk into the shop, they say, "Oh, this looks like your house," she says, chuckling. The couple moved into their historic 1,500-square-foot family home in Charlotte, North Carolina, 2 years ago. Timeless neutrals are her base, the pretty pops of color that show up on throw pillows, accent rugs, woven planters, and wall art solidify her mid-century bohemian-ish style. But it is the plants that pull it all together. I know that when we had the space, I was going to load up on houseplants, she said. I take pride in my plants. They are my babies. She also has a deep appreciation for African mud cloth. The handmade Malanian fabric is traditionally soaked in a bath of tree leaves before being sun-dried and methodically dyed with fermented mud to achieve its distinct look. As Faulkner notes, the story behind the mud cloth process really resonates with me. The title of the next article is called The Great Outdoors. Meet the Fraser family, Chef Rashad and Shaquita at Pulled Together, hit the road with their family for a weekend adventure exploring Portland, Oregon. It is our first time in an RV, says Shaquita. We put down our phones to get outdoors with the family and simply enjoy the journey. Hiking and hidden gems. To kick things off, they hiked the day away at Government Cove and Starvation Creek. This was our virtual detox. We are getting away to be outside, celebrate family, and focus on nature, says Rashad. With an RV being a new experience for them, Shaquita adds that they love the mobility and flexibility to stop whenever we saw someplace we wanted to explore, which is how they ended up taking in the beautiful views at Columbia Gorge, a place they didn't even plan to visit. Creating new traditions. That evening, their children, Zora and Ellis, made s'mores, and Rashad and Shaquita enjoyed a walk on the beach. The rhythms of nature are slow and soothing, says Rashad. That's how I would describe today. And now, Shaquita says, they will rent another RV for an upcoming family trip. Home away from home. Traveling to nearby Cascade Locks, they picked up fresh ingredients before heading back to the campsite. Nothing keeps morale higher than an amazing meal. Toss in a mobile kitchen, and our meal around a campfire is just that more magical, says Rashad. Go on a real vacation. Bored of camping in your own backyard? And maybe a little intrigued by the Fraser family getaway? Well, you can make this kind of a trip a reality for your family starting right now. Here are a few tips to make it happen. Get a good spot. From outdoor explorations to cultural hotspots, decide on a destination as a family. Choose a site. Find the best RV park, resort, or campground for you and your family in the area. Map it out. We all love GPS, but you may want to map a route before you get behind the wheel. Plan for rain. Be ready when the weather isn't ideal with board games, books, and movies. Have fun. Spending quality time together is what it is all about. The title of the next article is Bedtime Stories. Curl up with Bae for some erotic lit by Black authors. Here are five steamy classics just for you. Zane, the queen of Black erotica, takes us on a wild ride with one of her bestsellers, Addicted. The second book, short stories, anyone? The Blue Light Corner, Black Women Writing on Passion, Sex, and Romantic Love, is edited by Rose Marie. It's a passionate and at times reflective collection of steamy fiction and memoir that will light your fire in more ways than one. The third book, She's Digmatized by Tania Marie. Sadara Sims falls in love with a strapping guy named Sean. He's an Olympian in the bedroom, but Sadara learns that behind his intoxicating moves, there is a side to Sean that's more than she could have imagined. The fourth book, Sweatpants Season, by Daniel Allen, goes deep as it looks at the dueling emotional attitudes that men and women sometimes have about one another. And the fifth book, Black, a Love Story by Clarence Birdsong III, is an anthology of poems and short stories. We have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Ava Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.